Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Homage to the Buddha, the Blessed, Noble, and Fully Self-Enlightened One. So just to, as a way of revising for most of you, just the just that whole area around meditation, and just going through the factors of enlightenment and the characteristics of the three characteristics of existence and the five hindrances, just like that. These factors of enlightenment, unfortunately the title is given, the facts of enlightenment, gives the impression that there's something you get once you're enlightened. You know, that you receive them, as it were, at the end of the process. But they're all very natural virtues that we all have, which simply have to be honed, developed, and pointed really towards the path. So if we go through them, you'll see they're very ordinary qualities within us. Leaving awareness aside for a minute, this word concentration. So unfortunately that brings up a certain tension when we say concentrate, you know. Especially those of us of the old school, of the more mature types who've been in the older schools. Don't know what it does to younger folk these days when they say concentrate. I think the word focus is probably better. If you think of a camera focusing, yeah, it's a hazy picture, and then, as it were, things clarify, like. It's as though the whole power of your attention begins to center on something. See, that sense of really, you know, really centering in on something is I think a better way of looking at it. And the energy which balances that is all the energy you need, really. It's the only mental energy you actually need to just bring you know, that focus. Now, one word that's used in the, I think it's more in the commentaries rather than the scriptures, is the word ekagata, which means going one way. So that gives you the impression, or gives me the impression anyway, of attention being more like a laser beam. Like all the light is going one way. It's not being distracted. It's not frazzled. And to do that, you need a certain amount of energy just to get it there and to maintain it. So that's the point, to maintain it. If they're unbalanced, if your practices, shall we say, come to a point where the hindrances have disappeared, yeah. So you've got a lot of peace around. You've got a lot of peaceful state of heart, and the mind still, the body still, and the concentration and effort are there. See, if you get too much concentration and the effort begins to fall away, then you just fall asleep. That's what good concentration does. It takes you into oblivion. Yeah? And you can always tell the difference, because when you're falling asleep, your body does this business, you know, and you go banging your head on the floor. But when you actually lose your consciousness, as it were, you go into a state of unconsciousness, and it's from a point of view of strong concentration, not enough effort, and your body will stay exactly like that. Nobody will be able to tell at all. They'll presume that you're fully liberated and enlightened. And depending on how much you've developed that concentration, so you can stay in that state for quite some time. But from the point of view of the liberation, the path of liberation, it's a complete waste of time. Nothing. There is no insight to be had in a state of oblivion. It's just unfortunate. I must prefer to be asleep and wake up liberated. So that business of effort, you see, the effort is really only to observe clearly. That's all the effort you want. If the effort slips into this business of trying to see, and it's very difficult for us to make that distinction between just wanting to be focused, as it were, and trying to be focused. It's quite difficult for us to make that distinction. And as soon as you start forcing the system, as soon as you start forcing it, then of course you're putting in an extra energy, which is aggressive, really. Aggressive in the sense that it's in conflict with the way the mind is. So you're wanting it to do something it's not ready to do. And that's when you get the restlessness. And the mind starts shaking and you go all over the place. So you have to be patient, you have to wait, you see. So at the beginning of the meditation there, when I drew your attention to the breath, you see, you're waiting. There's part of us that's waiting for the body to become relaxed. And it'll become relaxed because you're not doing anything. You've sucked all the energy out of the body into the spine. And that's all you're doing. You're holding it up, you see. So although there might be feelings of this frazzled energy in the body, if you wait long enough, it begins to calm. And that's when you get that slow breath, or a more shallow breath, a more refined breath. Sometimes you can hardly feel it. It's difficult to feel it, you see. And that gap between the out-breath and the in-breath tells us how relaxed we are, because the body's not needing oxygen so much. See? So as you're sitting there, you're just watching, you're just feeling, and you're just letting the body come to... Just settling, you see. So this is the first instruction in the discourse on how to do this in the scriptures, you see. So the Buddha says, just be aware of the gross breath. Wait to calm the body and to calm the mind. So as soon as you calm the body, then of course the mind's affected. You know, the breath and the mind are very intimately connected, aren't they? You know, when you feel anxious, So. As soon as you start calming the body, then the mind, you see, calms down. But it won't do it without that intention. It won't do it without that purposeful intention of relaxing the mind on the breath, of just becoming aware of those sensations, you see. And that's why, in a sense, you have to develop this... A certain liking, a taste for the neutral, you know. I mean, our society is always about being excited. You know, what's the next thing to be done? It's always about jumping up and down. It's rarely about just sitting still. And it's really just contacting the breath and just seeing it as a place where you can relax. So normally you might go to a park or your armchair or something. But actually it's right here within you. The breath itself is a place where you can just relax. Just let the breath, just putting the attention on the breath relaxes the mind, you see. And it's finding that very lovely joy in that lovely pleasure in it, you see, which draws you to just want to sit still. As I say, sometimes you can help yourself by remembering how you do it in a more obvious way. See, a park bench, or the last time you walked along the seafront, or somewhere where you really felt just so relaxed. See, so bringing that memory brings with it the emotional quality of that memory, and then you just displace it, as it were, onto the breath, and that helps you just to develop that quality of calmness. Yeah. So now we've got the focus and we've got the energy, but you see, there has to be this calmness, as it were, running underneath it. See. So now, when those three things are there, when you raise that interest, that curiosity, instead of becoming excited, it remains a very calm disposition where you're just watching, just looking, just out of interest. See. Now again, if that interest, that curiosity, begins to move towards trying to see, trying to get behind consciousness, trying to see something, then the energy comes in and it starts making it restless. See, and these are very subtle slips in the mind. You know, often not aware of it. See. Because we're brought up to achieve, you see, brought up to achieve. Now, what do we mean by achieve? We mean that we're doing something now for some future result. So you're not in the present in a total way. Yeah, what you're doing now is because you want something else in the future. So the meditation is saying, no, don't do that, see. Come into the present because this is the achievement. To be aware of the present is the achievement. You don't have to go beyond the present to achieve anything. So if I'm looking and all I'm seeing is the same old stuff, you see, that's all right, I'm just seeing the same old stuff. If I say to myself, well, I'd like to see something new, see, then I'm looking for some other reason which isn't there. So I'm putting a sort of extra energy into it, and then it becomes restless. And then you have to remind yourself that insights, you see, don't come from the self. Spiritual insights don't come from a decision about me deciding I'm now going to have an insight. See, they're coming from a center which is outside my control. So I've got to get out of the way. Now, interestingly enough, this happens in other forms of knowledge, doesn't it? I mean, I have a friend who's a mathematician, you see, who will struggle with a problem, go to sleep on it, and occasionally wakes up with the answer in his head. Now, I did say oblivion was useless. But it's more in the sense that as he wakes up, you see, there isn't that tension around having to find the answer. And just in the relaxation of that moment where the problem rises, the answer comes naturally from a different center, from this center of pure intuitive intelligence. And that's what it is. It's pure intuitive intelligence. And this intelligence, remember, is prior to thought. Yeah, thought is a way that the intelligence expresses its understanding. And as soon as it does so, it's necessarily cramped, because words have defining limits. And words are things that carry history for us. Even if I'm communicating to somebody and say to you, this is a lovely apple I'm eating. See, what does that mean? As soon as the word apple enters your mind, it brings with it the whole of your history towards apples. And we connect, of course, with that word, but it's not any real connection an experiential connection until I give you my apple to have a taste of. Then when you chew the apple, you say, oh yeah, it's a nice apple. But your nice apple is not my nice apple, because we've had different experiences with apples. All we can agree on is that there's an area of appledom which we think is nice. Do you know what I mean? It's a sort of right. So we're doing that to ourselves through words. So this effort to lift the intelligence, this intuitive intelligence, out of its connection, out of its embeddedness, its delusive definition of words, of intellect, is the process of liberation. See? Now, this interest, this curiosity, runs around these three characteristics, which we'll come to in a bit. And that's what makes them factors of enlightenment, see? If the interest is in sorting out a mathematical problem, all well and good. There's not a problem with that. It just doesn't get you enlightened, that's all. It doesn't awaken the spiritual faculties. Yeah? Now, the next two are this equanimity with investigation of the Dharma. So now, you see, all these qualities are pointed to the investigation of the Dharma, the investigation of the Buddha's teachings. And that's balanced with this equanimity. Now, equanimity here is a complete and open receptivity to what's happening. There's no equanimity is not resisting anything. Whatever is offered, that is received in its fullness. Yeah? It's not referring to a calm heart. We've dealt with that, with a general calmness. This equanimity is an attitude of complete openness to what's happening. So when you're sitting there, no matter what comes up, you see, the most delicious pain, the most terrible thought, disgusting thought, you're completely open to it. See, you're not trying to put that judgmental mind in the way. You're not trying to resist anything. And that's this equanimity. Because it's only with that complete openness that you can begin to see what's actually there in our psyche. How, you know, what makes us tick. So these factors have to be balanced, you see. If the equanimity moves, then that looking will be prejudiced. See? If there's any judgmental mind there, presumption there, you see, then the intelligence is already distorted. It won't see anything. And you have to teach it. You have to teach it to be open like that. Even visually, you know. I remember when I first went to the East, I'm thinking specifically of an occasion in Sri Lanka, where I was walking along a path with somebody, and they pointed up at this tree and said, "Oh, look at the monkeys." I couldn't see them for the life of me, sir. I looked out, what monkeys? Couldn't see them at all. And it was only when I trained the eye, when I saw one of them, that suddenly all the others began to appear on this tree. But I hadn't seen the monkeys at all. And green parrots in green trees. But you do, eventually, the eye actually picks up these little things, you know. There was also the story of that I read somewhere of a man who was born blind who got his sight back, and a psychologist was taking him around teaching him how to see, and he took him to a zoo, and he couldn't see the apes in the zoo, in the cave. He couldn't see them, you know, even though he couldn't see them. So the psychologist took him to a statue of an ape and got him to feel it, and then he could see it. Yeah, you see what I mean? It's like, now that's all you're doing with this intelligence. The Buddha's teaching is very clear. He says everything's arising and passing away. Now we all know that. The seasons arise and pass away. We know the body grows old and dies. We know all that. But there's something in us that doesn't believe it. You know, there's something in us that says, no, but I'll keep going. And it's that delusion, you see, and we can't see it. See, the thing about delusion, isn't it, is that you can't see where you're deluded, else you wouldn't be deluded. See what I mean? It's like stigmatism in your eye. I mean, I have a stigmatism, it seems, in both eyes, for heaven's sake. But in this one, I went to, just recently, to an optician, and I put the new glass on, and this eye felt wrong. And it didn't feel right. And it was because the prescription didn't take into account the stigmatism. Now, for the life of me, I couldn't tell you where the stigmatism was. You know, it's the old window panes when they used to bend and you'd get a peculiar look through the window? You know, yeah? That's what a stigmatism is, it seems. It seems to be some sort of bend in the lens, you see, so you get this wavy, right? Now, I can't tell that. I can't even tell it when he told me I had it. Even when he pointed and said it's over here, I couldn't see it. But all I knew was when I put these glasses on, they didn't feel right. Strange, huh? I didn't sue him. So, where are we now? Oh, yeah. So, we've been through this concentration effort, the balance of them, yeah? We've been through the calmness and just this quiet investigation. Just out of an interest in things. We've talked about the equanimity, the openness, and the investigation of Dharma, So then now, the last one is this awareness. So now awareness is that quality of just simply knowing. Now the reason I've left it last is because it's a governing quality. As soon as you are into the position of knowing, all these factors will arise to support it. So in a sense, you don't have to worry about these factors at all. Yeah? In fact, you could forget everything I've said. And just just develop this quality of awareness. Now, that quality of awareness, the point where we can get to by an act of will, is the observer. This inner observation post, as somebody's called it. You can do that by an act of will. Yeah? In other words, you can become aware of the sensations in your body. You can become aware of the feelings in your heart, the emotions, the moods. You can become aware of the images in your mind. And with good concentration, you can become aware of thoughts. Now, to be aware of something means you're not in it. You must have separated from it. You must have distanced from it. That position you find is the position of the observer. Right? It's within yourself, and you can, as it were, looking down or looking at whatever's happening. Now that's right awareness, you might say. That's what the Buddha's pointing to as right awareness, that level of being aware. And it's right awareness when it's pointing to or looking at these three characteristics of existence. Because what the Buddha's saying is that this delusion, which we can't see, is manifesting because we cannot see the true quality of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness and not-self. See, so he's made it very easy for us now. He's told us where to look. Before we didn't know. Now we know where to look. So now the quality of impermanence is to really grasp that everything that I'm experiencing is arising and passing away. Everything. Yeah? Now, the quality of that systemically or psychologically, the way it affects the whole psyche, is that if really, truly, everything is arising and passing away, then what's the point of holding on to anything? Because it's not there as soon as I grasp it. Yeah? And so you get the Buddha saying there is nothing in the world worth holding on to. Now as you repeat that to yourself, you see in your heart there's nothing, just watch how you're reacting to it. See? So to actually see the arising and passing away of everything, right, even moments of consciousness, right? For instance, when you fall asleep, yeah, that's it, isn't it? That's the end of that day. It's died with sleep. Yeah? And what we do with this quality of impermanence is that we're aware of the beginning of things. Now, the beginning of things always brings hope. It always brings excitement. It always brings, yeah, there's always a lift, spring. We're always aware of the beginning of things. It's putting the accent, shifting the accent over to balance that with recognizing the end of things. The breath comes to an end. The day comes to an end. The meal finishes. The relationship ends. See what I mean? It's the ending. That's the bit we don't like to quite look at in the fullness of its meaning for us. And that's when you begin to shudder a bit. That's when that idea of a me begins to break up a little bit. See? Now, when you're sitting, you can set yourself that task as a task. You can say to yourself, well, this sitting, I'll try and keep my curiosity, my inquiry around seeing the ending of things, becoming aware of the ending of things. See? The next one is this unsatisfactoriness, this dissatisfaction, this dukkha. Dukkha is just, you know, whenever you translate from language to another language, it's always never quite right, is it? Dukkha, in its first meaning, just means a hard place. You know, that's what it is, isn't it? Life, life is a hard. This is a hard place, and then you die. So it's a case of, it's an old joke, isn't it? Life's hard and then you die. So this hardness, this where does the suffering arise, you see? How do we create suffering? Because in the Buddhist psychology, it's all created by the individual. It's not actually created by anything outside the individual. Nobody can cause you psychological pain. That's all inwardly created. So now we're looking at our psychology. This is also fairly immediate to us, because we can see when something pleasant arises, we're attaching to it. Now, the enjoyment of pleasurable things is heaven when we're enjoying them. That, you can't deny that. You can't, you know, sometimes you get these rather silly statements in Buddhism about, you know, pleasure suffering. But it's not, is it? It's wonderful. it's just that you've got to be aware of the aftermath of what happens after the indulgence, you see. Then you realize there's a connection between the grief around loss, the fear of losing, the frustration when you don't get it, that all the suffering actually that you've put down to other reasons is because of your initial indulgence and attachment to a pleasurable object. And that's when you begin to investigate this problem which is within ourselves, to see how we can form a relationship with what is pleasant without the indulgence. And you know, I'll talk a bit about this when we go for food, because that separation of enjoyment and indulgence is crucial if we're going to be happy. Yeah, really crucial. And remember that you don't know how attached you are to something till you lose it. You know, you can say, well, I can do without my car. I can do without a pair of shoes. It's like you don't really know how much your happiness is dependent on something or somebody until you lose it. And that separation of indulgence from enjoyment is translatable to all areas of our lives, remember. It's not just around the basic physical pleasures of food and whatnot. It's around relationships. How do you have a loving relationship without attachment? Is that possible even? You know? Around the joys, aesthetic joys, the joys of art, the joys of walking in nature. All these are given to us as part of our heritage. This is what it is to be human. It is to have these lovely things to enjoy. See? So it's a case of to be very clear within ourselves as to that separation between the enjoyment and the indulgence, which is very difficult because they're so close to each other. Yeah? And then remember, on the other side of that, you've got all the aversion. Now, aversion's easier to see because it kicks the object away, tries to get rid of it. Yeah? Paradoxically, it sticks to it because of that. You know, it's like, you know, if you hear the old thump coming through the, you know, from next door, you know, thum, 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 you know. So when that's coming through, you see, you get irritated and your ear glues onto the wall. I mean, you just cannot not hear it. So even though the hatred wants to annihilate it, it's stuck onto it until it gets rid of it. It's a sort of paradox. So then you begin to realize that aversion, trying to get rid of something, trying to annihilate something, also has its own problems. Eh? And then when it gets too much, you get that other thing too, of fear, anxiety, so running away from things. So those two qualities of pushing away and the fear, the running away, in the Buddha's understanding, was all one reaction of not wanting. See, so it's catching that game that we play of holding on to, wanting, grasping something we like, pushing away, not wanting, running away from what we don't like. And you have to see that mechanism within you, you see. And remember, it's just the seeing which is the liberating factor. Yeah. Now, in the meditation, I kept saying, don't do anything. See, that's very difficult for us. We want to change ourselves. See, now, if you're in a sort of double bind if you want to change yourself, because what wants to change you is what's deluded. Yeah? You're gonna really mess yourself up trying to change yourself. I think we're much better off if we allow, if we have enough faith in the process, to allow the change to arise naturally. All these negative qualities transform quite naturally into their opposites. You don't have to work so much at loving as work at letting go of aversion, because all that energy which we recognize as aversion isn't destroyed in the process, it's released, you see, and in releasing itself it always seems to move over to its opposite. So aversion transmutes into love, cruelty transmutes into, because if you think about it, if you find yourself being cruel and you feel that cruelty within you, and then you realize that this is a really ugly state of mind, a really ugliness, you know, and then you suddenly flip, as it were, and realize that actually you've actually hurt somebody, you see, then the compassion arises naturally. See what I mean? Those insights come naturally with the process, you see. Which doesn't mean to say that we can't obviously do exercises like we're going to do this afternoon, metta, to develop the better qualities of ourselves. But I think it's just you just have to be careful about that sentence. You know, I need to change. It's better to come from an insight about how we are rather than some idealistic idea of how I should be. That's all. It's a different process, isn't it? So you see how you are and you move towards what is better, not presuming you should be like this, creating an ideal to which you're trying to strive, and of course you'll never reach. You know, perfection just isn't possible, is it? And then the final this quality is this anatta, this not self. Now, unfortunately, people tend to think of that as a metaphysical statement. There is no self. But it's not. It's a teaching tool. It's just the way the Buddha was asking us to look at our experience and recognizing that actually, whatever I am, this is not it. This is not me. This is not mine. So as you're looking at sensations in the body, say the pain that comes up maybe in the knee from sitting, or the back or the head or whatever, as you're looking at it, you see, and you're aware of it, there's that distance, isn't there, between that which knows and what it knows. There's sort of a creation of a you can call it an inner space, yeah? So that when you're in that space, you can say, can't you, well, that's not me, it's not mine. And to actually make that a conscious thought is distancing it, you see. Now, as soon as you do that, your relationship changes. Before, if you thought it was me, you're fighting it. You're trying to change it, you're trying to do something. But if it's not me and not mine, then you can relax around it. But that observation of not me, not mine, you see, is undermining these identities we have. So the question arises, if that's not me, not mine, who the hell am I? Yeah, so you're looking at an emotion and you can feel it. You can feel the anger, the depression, the anxiety, the joy, the love. You can feel it as an emotion, and you're looking at it. You say, well, it's not me, not mine. So who am I? An image comes up in your mind and you look at it and you say, oh, I can see that. Who's this I that says it can see it? Because it can't be the I, because it sees it. If this is too mystifying, forget it. just keep with the initial transience, because that gets you there as well. Because everything arises and passes away, it can't be me either. All these three factors sort of lock into each other, these three characteristics. And then you recognize that everything you're experiencing, especially in the sitting posture, is not under your control. It's just happening. So that can't be me or mine either. Because one of the definitions of me is that I have total control. This is me, for heaven's sake. See? And if I don't want the pain in the knee, then it should go away. So, seeing that quality of everything being other than that which knows, you see, is as it were drawing us towards something which is maybe not impermanent. So the Buddha's always pointing to that which is not conditioned, not permanent. No, sorry, not impermanent. It's something which is not is unconditioned, not impermanent, not suffering. Okay. Now, when you get into that position of the observer, and you're well aware of the observer, so now you're aware of a self. If you're aware of a self, you can't be that either. Huh? Getting tricky now. You can't be aware of anything you're aware of. You can't be what you're aware of. See? So if I'm aware of me as a self-awareness, there's some mirror image going on there. Now, when that mirror image comes, you see, I can actually investigate that. I can find out where that's arising from. Yeah? And that will come. That will come when you're very quiet, when you're very still, when you're very alert and very awake. There is only this observer and the breath. So investigating that, finding out where that is arising, is also part of the process of understanding this whole doctrine around not me, not mine. Now that's what these factors of enlightenment are supporting. They're all there to support these investigations. Yeah? And even though when we come to sit, we can set ourselves, as it were, we can put a thought in our mind. So this is the way of the koan. Yeah? Like for instance, in Korean Zen, the koan is, who am I? Now you're not supposed to answer it. If you answer it, you get put away. I mean, that's the whole point. The idea is to say, who am I? And then see how the mind responds, you see. It's the moment after you've asked the question, which is really interesting. Because in that still moment, you see, and before the mind rushes in to tell you who you are. See? So to sit there and just lift that in curiosity, lift that desire to investigate through setting yourself a little task, at least at the beginning of the meditation. It takes you through a couple of minutes before... At least to sort of begin with that is a skillful thing to do, see, because it raises the curiosity, you know. And for those of us who have been meditating a long time, the danger is this laziness, really, that comes into the practice, you know, where you can sit comfortably for quite some time, but actually it's a waste of time, complete waste of time, because there's no effort there, there's no real investigation, but there's no brightness to the intelligence. It's just become a habit, see. And there's a danger in that, because eventually you don't see anything happening from your meditation, and then you let go one day and nothing happens. So you let go the next day and nothing happens. So it fades away. This, of course, is the path to perdition. There's no hope there. So, having developed these qualities of the facts of enlightenment, which we begin the meditation with, you begin every meditation with rediscovering those qualities of the factors of enlightenment, and you raise the interest to investigate, and then of course you get these hindrances coming in. So now, from the point of view of the practice, they're not hindrances at all. They've come as teachers. They've come as those things that really need to be investigated. So when we find ourselves off on fantasies around all the things that we desire, you see, we're interested, because here is the manifestation of dukkha. This is what dukkha is. It's right happening right here in my head. when my mind is off on aversions and fears and hatreds and depressions and all that, this is it. This is the manifestation of dukkha. Let's investigate this. Yeah? When that dullness and lethargy arise, and we know that we've had a good sleep, we shouldn't be feeling tired, you see, then we realize, oh, this is a manifestation of dukkha. See? This is through the indulgence. This is through seeking comfort in sleep. Taking refuge in sleep. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and the bed. It's finding a place where you can bury your sorrows. So as soon as you sit up, you just want to bury your sorrows. Hell, you want to live with them. Restlessness, when the mind just won't stop and the body's fidgety, when there's guilt and shame and all those ugly sort of states come up, see, then we see, now this is to be investigated. So we have a real positive attitude towards that part of our psychology which actually we find painful, which we would describe as, well, suffering. So for us, it takes on a different quality. It's an investigation of it. And what we're learning to do, isn't it, is to sit compassionately with it. See, so remember that when these things come up, you can flavour your looking with a kindness. See, I'm depressed again. So you can, and you have to sit with these things. You see, imagine you were sitting with a friend who was depressed. You see, so you just sit with them, you know, in a kindly way. Huh? You don't fall into the error of getting depressed because your friend's depressed. That's ridiculous. So it's the same with insiders. If I start getting depressed because I'm depressed, what hope is there? Then I get angry because I got depressed, about being depressed. Then I get so depressed, I get really afraid. So I'm really afraid I got depressed about being angry, about being depressed. It just goes on and on and on. So somehow I've got to find a way of just being equanimous with it. And to do that, I have to get another vantage point, which isn't, I want to get rid of this depression. Immediately I'm in conflict with it. See? It's more in the sense of, my dear old friend, express yourself, let me feel, depression. See? Let it manifest, you see? Then of course, that energy, with that distorted energy, it has the room, it has the space to exhaust itself. And that's the therapy of the practice. Yeah? And I always like to remind people, it doesn't cost you anything. It's a very, very cheap way of becoming sane. And then finally there's doubt. So doubt, remember, skeptical doubt is a real disease. It's a disease not only in the spiritual life, it's a disease in our ordinary daily lives. Because what skeptical doubt does, not honest doubt, not wondering whether this is right or wrong or whatever, skeptical doubt is the doubt which stops you committing yourself. So you never do anything. You know, is this the right job for me? Yes, no, yes, no, yeah, and the job goes. You know, is this the right relationship? Yes, no, yes, no, and it goes, you see. You won't take that leap of faith. There's no faith, there's no trust in oneself or in the other, never mind oneself. And that's a real killer. It just stops you doing it. It cramps your life, destroys it. Just end up being, a lump. A very depressed lump. Now in the spiritual life, you see, you won't go there. You say, I'm no good, you know. Everybody else can do it, but not me. I'm special like that. It's just sort of silly. And all this self-hatred stuff. But through the meditation, you know, you're open to it. That's the equanimity. You let it come. And no matter how strong it is, you let it be there. And then when it begins to fade away and a bit of clarity comes, then you make your decision. So you don't get fooled by these mental states. And that's one of the great blessings, I think, of Vipassana. That you stop being fooled by them. You know, when depression tells you that it's not worth living, when anxiety tells you that it's not worth living, you know, when doubt tells you that you daren't do it, you're not so caught up in that delusive thought, which is driven by what? By an emotion. An emotion is just a mental, what is it? It's a mental atmosphere. It's like when you walk in this room, it has an atmosphere. Now, whatever happiness is, it's not an emotion. How can it possibly be an emotion? Okay. Whatever love is, it's not an emotion. How could love possibly be an emotion? How could you love somebody when you don't feel good? Okay. So there's love and happiness, they're coming from some other centre. They're coming from some attitudinal centre, which is arising from wisdom. The fact whether the heart responds or not in terms of an emotional flavour is irrelevant. Now, when you get into that position of the observer, of the observation post, when that's very clear to you, when you're there, when you're not a body self, when you're not an emotional self, when you're not a thought self, when you're just that observing self, ask yourself, what does it feel like? And is this a better place to be than stuck in the body as a body self or an emotional self or a thought self? Okay. And it's beginning to identify with that state which is the process of liberation. Okay. And we can do this in a day if we try very hard. So if we take a little break now, because I think I've been going on a bit too much. Oh heck, I've been going on a bit too much. If we take just a 20 minute walk, and then we'll come back and sit.